My name is Will Bentley, and I'm the Controls Director for High Speed 2 Limited. Technically, I'm a senior civil servant. They didn't tell me that when I started, but I am. But essentially, High Speed 2 Limited is a 100% fully owned DfT company at the moment. But all that's about to change as we progress as a company with our organisation and our capabilities as we look to deliver the most exciting of projects. And my talk today really wants to take you through pretty much the rationale behind why we're doing High Speed 2 and then get on to the really exciting stuff for you controls folk, a look at our organisation and what we're trying to build in terms of a progressive, innovative controls organisation for the 21st century. So without further ado, I'm going to crack on. People are still joining and there's plenty of room at the back, as they say, or some seats at the front. About the topic, it's actually entitled EV, A Pragmatic Way, so I had to think hard about that one. And there is a slide in here about EV, so hopefully you can spot the slide about EV. I'm going to start, though, on a journey back in time, 190 years ago, literally 2 weeks ago, to the first public fare-paying passenger service in the world, which was the Stockton to Darlington Railway. The Stockton to Darlington Railway, George Stephenson, designed and built the railway, 14 miles, and the first ever journey that took place on the 27th September, 1825, the 14 miles in just under 2 hours. An actual remarkable feat in terms of the 14 wagons carrying coal, flour, miners, and fare-paying passengers. It created the first service in the world. And Stephenson went on from there to the other side of the Pennines and created the Manchester to Liverpool Railway, took part in the famous Rainhill Trials with his engine rocket, and of course the rest is really history. 20 years later, the whole of the north was joined by railways. And I think in 1842, there's over 100 railway acts going through Parliament. The creation of that railway alone saw the growth in the industrialisation of that part of the world. The small village of Middlesbrough grew up on the banks of the Tees, and the whole surrounding area became synonymous with industrialisation in terms of steel and mining, etc., which, of course, is incredibly ironic and poignant because, as we know, what's just happened, and in fact, I brought it with me, in today's Financial Times, the big headline is that steelmaking ends on Teesside. Essentially, what we've seen is a massive demise in the manufacturing industry across the north and across the country as a whole. If I put that into context, and I know Stephen Norris talked about a bit this morning, 30 years ago in this country, there were over 40 blast furnaces. With the switching off of the Redcar blast furnace, the second largest in Europe, basically brings to an end, effectively, bar one blast furnace in the UK. The impact of that on the north, in particular, that part of the north, is quite detrimental. Over 2,000 people lose their jobs directly, another 4,000 people in the supply chain. So that basically, the irony is clear. 190 years ago, Stephenson ran his first train, 10,000 people there to greet it. 190 years later, almost to the day, we see the end of the manufacturing base of Teesside. But of course, that isn't the story that very often gets told. The real story that we're led to believe is that in fact, we're enjoying a rapid period of growth. 10 successive quarters of growth. And, as the quote says, we've rarely had it so good. The quote is from RBS. And who can tell me who owns RBS? We do. The taxpayer does. The people of Teesside own RBS. It's obviously a public-owned company and has been for about 7 or 8 years. So the truth is, we have this dichotomy, don't we? We have essentially the end of manufacturing in the north, and we have a buoyant economy in terms of growth. And that's obviously down to the fact that what we can see is whilst manufacturing is actually static, or in fact decreasing, the service sector, if anything, is still growing. And if you roll that picture forward 30 years, what might that look like? In terms of an economy that is basically almost separated between a service sector in the south and an economy that's in decline in the north, if it isn't already there. And of course, the government, very strong on the back of the northern powerhouse, is seeking to address that. If the north is to be given the vital connections and connectivity it needs, it would become stronger than it is today. And if you took the north in context, it is the 20th largest economy in the world. So actually, what we're trying to do here is not just create connectivity, it's about rebalancing Britain. The whole story is actually a play forward for 30 years. And when I talk to people in the Treasury, they tell me the story, that how it could play out. If you imagine a situation 30 years from now, where the UK GDP keeps growing quite healthily, 2 to 3%, but actually the economies of the Far East, China, Indian subcontinents are growing at 10 or 12%, there will come a tipping point somewhere along that route when our economy goes into mass decline. We have to do something for the future to alleviate that. And that probably is the most telling story of High Speed 2. It isn't just about commuter travel. It's not just about getting somewhere quicker and faster. It's about being a catalyst for growth. It's about regenerating our cities, and it's about creating an economy that can sustain itself, just as those pioneers like Stevenson did 190 years ago. And the facts speak for themselves. I mean, house prices in the southeast at the moment, buoyed on by that growth in the economy, somewhere in the region of 5 to 1 compared to the north. And anybody, you know, young, trying to set out in London at the moment, trying to buy a flat, good luck to you. Come up to where I live, you can buy a house about 170 grand for a four-bedroomed house. We have to do something to try and rebalance, lower house prices, and create that northern powerhouse. The same is true for rateable values as well. London sticks out. It's at saturation point. So this is not just a story about trying to get growth and economic growth into the north. It's about trying to actually address the problems we face also in the south as well. Same goes for pay. I mean, without shadow of a doubt, the issues are the south still is a draw for young, talented people in this country. And again, with the connectivity that High Speed 2 Limited is trying to bring into play, we can actually create a northern powerhouse that can start to address those balances. And I think it's a story for me personally that, having spent 30 years literally travelling up and down from the northwest, the idea that, you know, future generations can stay and prosper in that part of the world and people can come from other parts to there and rebalance is definitely something that I would like to be part of. So, in essence, the vision is to be a catalyst for growth across Britain. And it's not just, I would suggest, High Speed 2 issue. Managed motorways and other infrastructure investment is needed to make that happen. But certainly High Speed 2 can actually be one of the key catalysts for growth. But of course, it's not just about trying to recreate the economy. The fact is, we have an issue in the rail industry. The likelihood is we will surpass 1.7 billion train passenger per kilometre in the next 2 or 3 years, which means we've seen a growth, an unprecedented growth of over 100% in the last 10 years. And on the basis that we've not built a new railway north of London in over 120 years, we have to do something to actually improve the supply of service. So rail demand continues to rise. But of course, as I experienced this morning, mass overcrowding in the south and poor connectivity in the north. So High Speed 2, again, is not just about getting people from Birmingham to London and London to Birmingham quicker. It's about providing connectivity also at those points. When Crossrail comes on service in a few years' time and High Speed 2 is functioning from Old Oak Common, that will improve connectivity in the south quite a lot, and also connectivity in the north as well. I'm sure anybody who tries sort of travelling across country as well will experience that. It's also about regenerating our cities. High-speed 2, compared to a lot of international rail projects, is not just going actually from city to city, or even in most cases stopping short of city to city. If you catch Milan to Bologna, you'll find yourself off the high speed at least 5 kilometres outside of Milan. High-speed 2 will go into the centre of towns and cities. It will also stop at intermediate stations. The idea here is to help regenerate the cities along the route as well. It's all about a strategic transformation, therefore. Our phase one project from Birmingham to London is essentially going through the third and final reading stages of the House of Commons right now. We're in a select committee process, hearing the final petitions that will ultimately hopefully lead to royal assent in December 2016. And a scheme of this magnitude doesn't come without consequences. Obviously, the environmental impact, those that are affected on the route have to be taken into consideration. And the select committee process has actually been sitting for 2 years, hearing all those petitions. Once we get to Birmingham, the plan is to head further north in a sort of Y shape, if you like, with phase two extending towards Crewe and then to Manchester, and the Y carrying through to East Midlands Hub, Sheffield, and ultimately to Leeds. And of course, many of you will have heard of phase three, which will actually be the northern link at the top. There is also, of course, plans and a potential to move further north as well with phase four to Scotland. But ultimately, within the timescales for the next 10 years, we'll see phase one being built. Planned opening date is 2025. What will that give us? It will give us much faster journey times, which are more frequent and reliable. Typical times from Birmingham to London, down to 49 minutes. Sheffield Midland to London, down from 2 hours to 1 minute 19. That's a change in lifestyle. It means tourism, leisure, and all those other things come into play, not just about economic creativity. The idea is that you could, for example, get on a train in London, go and see a concert in Manchester, and be back the same evening, sort of. Typically typifies what could be achieved under high speed too. But ultimately, those journeys in terms of fast, frequent and reliable are looking at an increase in volume of something around 300 passenger seats a day. It means 18 trains per hour leaving from London to Birmingham, which alone will actually offset a lot of the issues we have in terms of supply at the moment within the rail industry. It's also about a high-tech programme for a high-tech economy. If I play back to what I said earlier about the economy in 30 years' time, what is the future of the British economy? It's all about creating a high-tech manufacturing capability and very much being able to export those services along with our current sort of tertiary services around the world. If we don't make that change, then the future of Britain isn't that great. But within that context, that also means we have to invest heavily in new skills colleges, we have to invest in education to actually get ourselves into a position where we are becoming a high-tech economy. But as I said, 30 years from now, lifestyles will be different. We'll probably only work literally 2 days, possibly 3 days at the workplace. The rest of our time will be either at home or another location. But we will still need to make fast and frequent journeys. And the predictions are that high-speed 2, as has been evidenced elsewhere, will be a big enabler to help us achieve that. Developing the people within our industry is a key facet of what we're all about. We are creating two new skills colleges, two new high-speed rail colleges, one based in Doncaster, one based in Birmingham. And we'll create the next generation of engineers, along with other infrastructure skills colleges in energy and STEM technologies. We hope to start the basis for creating the high-tech economy that we seek to create for Britain. But in its own right, a construction project of this magnitude will create its own supply of labour force, etc. Over 25,000 construction jobs will be created through High Speed 2. 2,000 new apprentices will have their first job as a result of High Speed 2. And one of the issues we face as a country is the fact that we cannot produce, over the next 10 years, enough engineering graduates. We predict somewhere in the region of a demand of about 83,000, and last year we turned out 37,000. So the combination of skills colleges and an investment in new technology centres, etc., will go a long way to trying to create what we need to create, not only to build this job, but also to service the demand. You'll see up from the table behind me, the graph behind me, that a lot of those jobs are also based in the north. This is the vitamin boost, if you like, for the northern powerhouse. We need to create those jobs in the locations where they will be needed, and hopefully that's what we will achieve. So, how is our company growing? And essentially, High Speed 2 was set up 5 years ago. Anthony Adonis, the then Secretary of State for, no, sorry, 7 years ago, Secretary of State for Transport, had the idea. A study was commissioned, and soon after, an organisation was born that created the what we now know as High Speed 2 Limited. So over the last 12 to 18 months, the organisation has grown from over 400 to now just peaked at 1,100 people. We're going through the hybrid build process that I mentioned just before, and at the moment we're still establishing our company. And in fact, our headquarters will be based in Birmingham, where we'll move next year in Curzon Street, and that will be able to accommodate up to 1,400 people, which is probably the maximum limit we see as an organisation in terms of numbers. At the moment, we're establishing the programme itself, and we're also moving into a phase of running a company. And all that comes with a mass of assurance and governance processes. We're currently heading to what's known as RP1, which is Review Point 1. Review Point 1 is the point at which we get more delegated authority to act as a company in our own right. At the moment, everything that we procure, everything that we manage, has to have the tacit agreement of both the DfT and the Treasury. So RP1 for us is a major hurdle in terms of our capability as an organisation. It's about proving ourselves. It's about proving the strategies that we need to put in play. To summarise that, we have a main delivery strategy, and we have 41 sub-strategies that feed into that. And programme control strategy is one of the key strategies that we've actually got, which we've actually written. So you can see from that, there's a lot of work to do just about setting ourselves up for success. Following on from April the 27th, 2016, when hopefully we will achieve RP1, we then go through the next phase into RP2, which basically enables us to make and place all the key contracts that we wish to place for phase one. And finally, in December 2016, to coincide with Royal Assent and the plan, we would achieve RP3, at which time we get all our delegated authority. But just to get to RP1 in terms of writing strategies, writing processes and procedures, having them verified, validated by independent assessors, making sure our organisational capability is in place to achieve what we need to, is the massive challenge we face right now. HS2 is organised in a classic matrix structure. That means to say that we have three essential clear directorates: phase one, development, and the business operations. Phase one is pretty much all about the construction from Birmingham to London. Development looks at all the aspects of future phases, including the hybrid build process itself. And because at some point we will want to set up a proxy operator to run this railway, we have a business operations and a development function that is in the embryonic stage of development. To the side of that, we have the directorates, of which program strategy is one of the key ones, which is where program control sits. But if you think about it like this, and I often get daunted by the fact, if that was a commercially trading company, it would be a FTSE 100 company already. Each of those three directorates, the MDs, is essentially in charge of 18 to 20 billion pounds of taxpayer money. So you can draw your own conclusions from that, but that means we have to have a strong, rigid structure of organisational development and capability sitting between it. The matrix organisation is there for agility and flexibility, with future phases being added as and when. But for now, the organisation that is essentially here to run the railway, is in place. Focusing pretty much for you guys on the controls function, it doesn't take a sort of standard approach. We have the Programme Strategy Directorate itself, and then we have an integrated programme management office, which essentially looks at the wider sphere of High Speed 2. It looks at the DfT involvement, Network Rail's involvement, as well as ours. Pretty sure you can imagine that there is a massive interface with Network Rail for this scheme, because we will be running trains both on the High Speed Rail itself as a captive railway and also on the classic conventional railway. That means you can get a high speed train from London to Glasgow. Okay? It will turn onto the existing infrastructure somewhere north of Birmingham. And therefore, the amount of involvement with Network Rail and other stakeholders necessitates the need for an IPMO. And then there's the PMO function itself. A scheme lasting this long over this period of time needs its own knowledge management centre. It needs to be able to grow the competency of the organisation and function as such. Programme controls, which I heads up, looks after the cost, the schedule, the change management, and very much focuses on the need for some of the specialisms that might be embedded within other parts of the controls function. So, for example, I have a head of earned value. I have a head of work authorisations. I have a head of baseline scope and integrity. Such is the size of the scheme, you need those functions almost acting in their own right. And then we have risk assurance and also the programme strategy function itself, which looks at the wider growth aspects, the equality, diversity and inclusivity, which is a key function of High Speed 2 Limited. Unlike any other rail organisation, we currently have a proportion of men to women of 43% women in our organisation. And we're very proud of our EDI policy and what that means for us and the wider communities. I mentioned RP1, so it's pretty much right now all about proving our capability. Proving our capability in terms of a functional matrix in terms of people, process and systems. And what we're doing at the moment is making sure that those strategies, those 41 strategies that I outlined earlier, are basically integrated and function as one. And functional owners for each of the key areas are in play, and that all our processes are defined, our systems are essentially specified to meet both our current and future growth around that, and our people in terms of competency are the best and trained and competent and knowledgeable in all that they do. So essentially, going through this process involves a lot of internal and external involvement. At the moment, our capability, our method of assurance is pretty much, as you would expect, institutional in terms of having people like the APM review what we do and in fact set some of the pace. And in fact, that's a two-way street. We help set the pace of the APM as well. In a few weeks' time, the APM will be spending the afternoon with us going through the processes and systems and trying to draw on a wide range of experience across different industries. Formal assessments, CMMI, P3M3, start to follow once we have our processes established. And following on from that, accreditation, which we achieved in July this year, we got Part 1 ISO 9001. Peer review is an important part of what we do. Myself and some of our colleagues will be at Sellafield on Friday looking at knowledge management, knowledge capture. We talk regularly with Crossrail, Thames Tideway, TfL, and people like Sellafield, who are all publicly funded organisations, about what best practice looks like and what good can be and what excellence we need to achieve. And finally, client reviews. The Major Projects Authority takes a very keen interest in everything that we do, and we have a series of MPA audits between now and next April when we achieve, hopefully, RP1. So my life, if you like, is full of process, build and audit. Process, build and audit. It's kind of like a continuing theme. So what is our program control strategy? And what should a program control strategy for a project program of this size, of this magnitude, and of this importance really look like? Well, it's all about essentially looking at the best that I've just alluded to of what's out there, and essentially looking at what appropriate controls there are. It's about looking at the sense of direction of a lot of the controls features that we would expect to employ in a program like this, and also educating the supply chain as we go through. We have a mantra and a mission to deploy BIM as part of the government's desire to see BIM on all major projects. We need to be a pace setter. A pace setter in BIM that looks at, for example, not just the systems side of it, but the conventions by which we code our objects, the way that we interrelate our work breakdown structures with those objects, and the way we can use our estimating systems to actually inform and take off from our drawings. And we're quite well advanced in some of that at the moment. We have proved our links and our capability between the design processes and our cost estimating and scheduling systems. But it's also about developing the capability as well. A lot of my team I've worked with previously on other schemes, places like Heathrow, etc., they bring with them the best-in-class expertise that the industry can offer. And we look to draw from that expertise from not just only in our immediate circle, but actually on a global setting as well. We also need to make sure that we have robustness between the technical scope and the cost and delivery of the schedule. And in order to do that, we take very, very detailed and serious looks at what comparators can give us from international benchmarking. We have comparators from 31 different high-speed lines in the world, which we can draw on in terms of the technical scope and cost and delivery of schedule. So we know where we fit within the world sense of high-speed rail and its development. And of course, it's all about managing the integration and the flow of scope. This is a project and a program that has a mass of change in terms of the impact around change management. And we have to be able to deal with that in an efficient way. The control strategy also is very keen, and it looks at the independent change management process that I just talked about there, because actually one thing is for certain, change will happen. And as we go through the petition management process, we're seeing the design development change, for example, as the select committee make recommendations on what that might be. We have to make sure, because again, scrutiny dictates, but also best practice tells us we have to, we have a robustness between our cost estimating and our cost management framework. There is a flow through in terms of our cost estimating process into the post-contract world, and then the closed loop of contract of outturn cost feeding into the estimating process. We have to have schedule planning and schedule management framework that sits alongside that and works effectively as well. We've constantly been asked by government to actually accelerate some of these works based on the scenarios that you've seen that are actually happening in the real world out there. The race to create the Northern Powerhouse and to have assured opening as quickly as possible is a key component of the government's aims. And I should also point out that this has got total cross-party support. And in fact, only recently, the story that we told you about the need to create that economy of the future, when it was played back to the leader of the opposition, they almost did a U-turn overnight and actually basically said, now endorses this programme, just wants to make sure it's held within the public office. And that's pretty much what we're all about. We have to be able to provide confidence to government that we can deliver on time and onto budget. And to do that, we need the best metrics, the best standards. And this is taking pretty much standard controls to a new level. It's looking at new techniques like line of balance, where you can measure the quantities, the cost, and the schedule durations directly from your drawings and how that relates back into performance of the supply chain. And we have to think carefully on how we can deploy those on such a fast scale that High Speed 2 is actually looking to achieve. And defining those metrics isn't just about us reporting. It's about taking the supply chain with us. It's about making sure that the employer's requirements, the works information, is all ingrained within the supply chain itself. Here's the slide. This is my title of my speech, which I managed to conjure up quite quickly when I saw the title. We do have, as I said earlier, we have a head of earned value, which is probably doesn't exist on many programs or many projects. Well, head of earned value has written a very detailed process guidance around how we wish to deploy earned value. It's all about defining what the process should be and how we want to deploy it. If we want to operate as a relatively thin client or a thin intelligent client, we therefore have to make sure that the earned value processes are fully embedded within the supply chain. Not only that, we have to make sure that they are understood as part of the contractual requirements, so that under an NEC type A or an NEC type C, the activity-based schedules, etc., that we have are form basis of what we want to achieve in terms of earned value. What that means is that at the coalface, at the delivery, at the actual construction side of things, we can measure progress in terms of our programme, our cost, our actual cost of work, our application for payments, etc., are all measured at the lowest level and then feed upwards. So by the time they hit us as a client, pretty much all the arguing, if you will, about progress, etc., has gone away, and we can see clear line of definition and clear line of sight between all our metrics. It's all about establishing the correct baselines. A process we're going through now, we're up to baseline 6 on phase 1, which is really the first time we've done a bottom-up cost estimate with a schedule linkage at a detailed level. And hopefully when that's done, we've got the form and basis by which we can start to set baselines. At the same time, when we go out to the market and our tender prices are coming back, within 9 months' time, we should be in a position to place early works contracts and move towards the main civils contracts 6 months later, sometime in mid-2017, at which time we'll be able to set realistic performance measurements baselines for our supply chain. And then after that, of course, it's all about the analysis and forecasting, about making sure that the information is robust and credible in the process. We recognise there's a need to improve the maturity within the supply chain. We've generated, it's pretty standard, but the EVM compass and maturity process is one that we will embed and expect as part of our supply chain requirements. And wherever we can, we will do our bit to educate and inform the supply chain of what's required to run a successful EV process. At the moment, because, as I mentioned, our hands are tied pretty much in terms of the procurement process, we have actually procured software that's available on the G Cloud, because that's our only route to actually going to market. That will change as we get through RP1 and RP2. But at the moment, we naturally have Primavera. We have Deltek Acumen Fuse that sits alongside that in terms of quality, and I'll draw more on that in a minute. We use Prism G2 for cost performance and its module Costos, which gives us good links into the 4D environment for cost estimating and BIM. One of the beauties of that is we can take information through the 4G viewer process directly from drawings into the estimating system. We have EB as a document control. Xactium is a web-based risk management tool, and we're using Tableau as our business intelligence and management reporting tool. I don't expect you to read that. On the basis I've got about 8 minutes left, I'm not going to ask you to read that. But just know that what we're doing is a very structured capability drop in terms of those systems to make sure that we've tested and embedded them to the extent that they fully work and are fully operational by the time that we go to the market and place orders. I mentioned BIM. We are very much an integrated entity in the way that we look at BIM. BIM is not just managed by the technical department. It's managed across the organisation as well. And as I said, we've already done proof of concepts in terms of our BIM strategy between making sure that cost and schedule are integrated in terms of how we actually move forward. And that's going to be an interesting development over the next 6 to 12 months. And I'd like to come back here, probably this time next year, and share with you some of the visual impact that can be delivered. We're at the first stages of delivering that at the moment, but the first results are quite exciting. Planning at high speed too. I thought I'd just drop in on that because I know many of you are controls experts and planners, etc. We have a very functional fixed line management. Planning is taken very seriously within our organisation. We're currently doing all our business organisation, business planning, and I've got a team of about a dozen planners just looking at the build, the organisation build, the railway aspects of that. That means we're going through a transitional state into a target operating model within 3 years, and the planning function drives not only the deliverables we have to achieve, it also drives our budgeting and our resourcing as well. So at the very hub of the organisation, we aim to have, in the imminent future, a process by which everything is driven from the plans that we have. We have a fully aligned WBS and CBS. We use pretty much level 8 of our WBS in terms of the asset definition to combine both cost and time, and then obviously feed into the BIM world. And of course, that drives, therefore, everything that we do in terms of planning, cost, performance, and as I already talked about, EVs driven from supply chain and supply chain schedules. Schedule quality is written into the High Speed 2 contracts. So, for example, we expect our suppliers to hit a certain hurdle rate in terms of schedule capability and quality definition. Otherwise, that's a reason for rejection of the schedule. The EPS is starting to pretty much, it's been through several iterations, I'm sure you can imagine, but it's now settling down. And as I mentioned, work package level 8 is pretty much where a lot of the metrics for EV and, if you like, the coming together of CBS and WBS takes place. A unique feature on such a large programme is the need for a design authority process. Otherwise, we might have phase one doing their own thing, development doing their own thing, operations doing something different, etc. So the design authority process, if you like, takes our matrix organisation, stands it on its side, and looks at, say, planning as a community across phase one development and the other operations as well. What that means is we get consistency, we get definition in terms of process. That means we can rotate people through our organisation, through the matrix, quite easily because we're all basically working to the same process. Each of those areas has their own community of practice. There is a planning community of practice. There's a project management community of practice. Our planning is called P4. Our cost is called 10cc, cost and change. It's just a simple way of making sure that everybody is on the same page and working together in the same way. I sit as the Uber DA in terms of the controls function. So I'm responsible for the P4 in terms of the planning processes, etc., that are brought to me in terms of seeking approval, etc. I mentioned before the need to build scheduled confidence into all that we do. And what we've devised is a straight take from an Acumen Fuse output and built into that a technical and a scope indicator as well. So you don't just get your ribbon analyzer that you get from Fuse in terms of saying this program is of a certain quality. You're also blending in technical characteristics and scope characteristics to give an overall SEI score for that schedule. And believe you me, that's quite effective. And hopefully, in the future, we'll build that into our contracts. So essentially, leading processes and technology within a progress PMO framework is pretty much about bringing all that together in a structured way that will not only benefit ourselves, but benefit other programs and projects. And as I said, it's an important facet that we talk regularly with other organizations and share our best knowledge as we go forward. Hopefully what that gives us is an exceptional passenger experience in terms of where we're going in terms of high speed two. We aim to set our cost, our ticket prices at a fair and reasonable amount, given the fact that we are increasing the supply of service inordinately as we go forward. But also the design, etc., elements that go into this are being meticulously thought through. And what does that give us? Hopefully, at the outset, I talked about the need to do something to rebalance the economy. The fact is, we need to do something now, and we need to plan for the future and take a look at what Britain needs to look like in 30 or 40 years' time in terms of a high-tech economy. And hopefully, if we do that and we deploy best-in-class controls processes, and I hope that many of you here are involved in that journey, if we do that, we create a legacy for those that come after us. We should see the results that London grows sustainably and the Midlands and the North achieve their full potential. Okay, so thank you very much. I think I've got about 2 minutes for questions. Thank you.